This is June Dobrovich, representing the Heritage Education Commission for their oral history project. I'm interviewing Mildred Heifert, a multi-talented lady who has promised to share with us her memories from a lifetime of involvement with the art of needlework in many mediums. Mildred, what are your roots? Could your ancestry have been an influence in your many artistic pursuits?
Oh, indeed they were. My mother, of course, was the first one, but she was a very good sewer, and she sewed for her large family, for the girls and even for the men. The boys would get their shirts and nightshirts, and the men their big plaid nightshirts. And then another one who was a great influence was my Aunt Laura. She was not my aunt, she was my mother's aunt. But to all of us, she was Aunt Laura.
Well, who taught you to crochet?
Well, that's a kind of a strange story. I spent a lot of time with Aunt Laura. She took me home with her whenever she could. And I stayed with her from the third, fourth, and fifth grades. Well, Aunt Laura had quite a large house, and she had two extra bedrooms that she used to rent for sleeping rooms. And one was occupied by a lady who was the telephone operator. And she was a very pretty woman. She had dark hair, and she kind of increased her healthy look, which was a little tint on her cheeks. I didn't know about that at that time. I knew about the face powder because my sisters and my aunts used that. And she used to invite me into her room, and one time she was tinting her cheeks, and I think she probably noticed my interest, or maybe I even asked her. But she asked me not to tell anybody about that. And later she gave me a boy doll named Cuddles that I was very fond of. I think she was bribing me a little. Mm. But she knew what she was doing when she sat and crocheted pretty crocheted collars for her dark dresses. You know, they made a frame around her face that really would made her look very healthy and beautiful, and I'm sure her suitors noted that.
And she taught you to...
Well, Aunt Laura got a bone crochet hook and some red yarn, and she taught me the crochet stitches. And I crocheted them over and over. I didn't make anything, but I raveled that yarn and I crocheted it again and again, and that's where I learned to crochet.
Well, the crocheting came first, and then I suppose everybody learns to knit.
Well, the knitting came. I was a little bit older then. Mm-hmm. World War I, all of the magazines had directions for Red Cross knitting. And the Red Cross wanted to furnish socks for the soldiers that were not free, that wouldn't blister their feet. They also knitted sweaters and helmets and washcloths. But I knitted one washcloth, and that was tedious, but I took these magazines that had the directions.
You mean they were sort of specifications, Mildred, as to how you had to knit these things? Certain rules or specifications?
Well, yes, they only accepted socks that had a certain kind of toe and heel knitted, and it was called the Kitchener heel and toe. Well, the yarn was distributed by the government through the Red Cross chapters, and my older sister was chairman of that knitting project in the county in which she was teaching. Well, there were many older women who were wonderful, fine knitters, but they didn't have that particular knowledge of knitting the Kitchener heel and toe. So my sister made the mistake of taking her little sister to teach these older ladies.
How'd that go?
And they weren't all too happy about it, having a child teach them. But, you know, patriotism was so high in those days, they wouldn't think of not making the right toe for the government. So they accepted it.
Could I ask you how old you were at that time when you were knitting for the Red Cross?
I was about 12.
12, yes. Mm-hmm. Well, had you already been sewing your own clothes then, Mildred?
Oh, yes. I had made one dress. Mm-hmm. That was kind of a strange experience.
Sounds like there's a story behind this. Go ahead and tell us.
Well, I was begging my mother to let me make a dress, and materials were a little bit expensive, so she produced a piece of red calico that was kind of out of date, and, you know, patterns didn't have directions like they have now, mm-hmm. But she gave me the material and the pattern and the pins, and she told me to stretch that material out on the dining room table and to pin every piece before I used the scissors. Well, when I thought I had it all pinned, I couldn't find her. She'd gone to the neighbor's, so I couldn't wait. I got the scissors out, and away it went.
Mm-mm.
Well, when I got it all cut here, I found I hadn't included the pattern for the collar. Well, it was unthinkable to have a dress without a collar in those days. So I went through everything, and finally I found a piece, and I cut the collar. Well, I went to checking. I had used the piece that had been cut for the back of the blouse.
What did you do about that?
Well, I just was sick. And my mother kind of chuckled. She didn't take it too seriously. But we put it away, but I was just simply brokenhearted to think I couldn't get at that dress and stitch it up. But dear old Aunt Laura saved the day. She had some of the same material that she was using for a quilt, so my dress was finished. And I enjoyed wearing that dress because I had made it myself.
Well, that was the first, I'm sure, of many. And as you grew a little older, then you sewed for yourself. Did you sew for others?
During high school, I sewed for my schoolmates. And then after that, I sewed for most anybody, everybody.
I suppose then from that kind of practice, you learned some skills that led to perhaps something that paid alterations? Or?
Well, yes. I just naturally, I took anything that was in the sewing line. Mm-hmm. And I had plenty of business, I can tell you.
Well,
you didn't get paid awfully well, but no. You know, living wasn't expensive then either. So.
Well, did you get paid for any of that early work?
Well, I did for my first piece of crocheting.
Hmm.
I think I was 12 then, too. And we had a neighbor who had a great love for beauty. She loved laces and pretty things in her home, and she had very little. But she had a big folding bed in her home that she wanted a scarf to put over the top. A folding bed is a piece of furniture that looks something like these antique wardrobes that we are busy collecting now.
Do we call it a Murphy bed, or is that not?
No, a Murphy. Quite. Murphy.
That went inside a closet, didn't it?
Yes, or a recess in the wall. This went in. This bed went into the cabinet, but it wasn't as high as a wardrobe. So if you put a scarf over the top, the lace would be exposed.
I see.
So she came with a box of crochet that and begged me to crochet some medallions to edge a scarf, which I did. Mm-hmm. Well, my mother sewed the medallions on the Belgian linen, and the lady was so happy, and she put $2 silver in my hands.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I refused because I didn't think anybody should be paid for doing something they enjoyed as much as I had. But she persisted, and I had to keep the $2 silver.
Well, that leads me to another question. I don't suppose anyone ever gets paid, like you say, the amount that they should have for the time that you put in on this kind of thing. But are there other compensations that you get for this creative art that you do?
Oh, yes. I get so many letters and cards and notes and telephone calls even, and, of course, personal contacts where they just love and appreciate the things I do.
Everything that you
and
do.
I have made so many friends. My needlework has opened doors for me that I don't know anything else I could have done would do.
Mm-hmm. Well, I first met you when, by word of mouth advertising, when someone told me how wonderful you were.
Okay.
You created some very special window treatments in my very first home. How did your years in the draperies and slipcovers and decorating, how did they begin, Mildred?
Well, they became out of a clear sky. I had never enjoyed taking care of my own window problems and never thought of going into it. But one day when my second child had started school, the first one had started the year before, was a rainy Friday, and my telephone rang about 10 o'clock in the morning. And it was a call from the manager of a drapery department in a furniture store. And their drapery seamstress had asked for time off because of a terminally ill husband. So the girl in the office who had recommended me had called me, and then she turned me over to this department manager. And I explained that I knew nothing about it. Well, she said she would train me and asked me to come down. I went down in a pouring rain with a borrowed umbrella.
Something like today.
And she convinced me to try it. So I went home and fixed lunch for my children and went back to work at 1 o'clock. My husband had early hours, so he was home when the children came from school.
Well, how long did you work there?
Oh, a little over a year. And then I decided that my children needed their mother. they weren't happy about coming home from school and no mother there.
That's the way your family reacted to your working.
Yes, that's right.
You established a wonderful reputation, Mildred, in a very short time of public working that is connected to this furniture store. To what do you attribute your success in decorating? I mean, you know, you worked there a year and a half, and then all of a sudden you were just really in demand. You were a one-man business at that point.
That's right. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I don't understand that because I hadn't done any other decorating work any other place. I had done a little sewing at home when I was called for during the time I was working there. But as far as the draperies and the slip covers, I don't know how it got out, but
well,
on Monday...
You worked for a lot of people in a year and a half. Obviously,
yes.
Everybody you worked for was highly satisfied.
Well, yes, and they knew who had done it, mm-hmm. the actual sewing. But by Monday, my telephone was ringing. And at that time, most everybody worked for WPA wages. So while I worked downtown, I did a little better than that. I got 50 cents an hour.
Well...
But I decided... I was going to stay home with the children, and the first week I was home, I had tripled the income of the weeks that I had worked downtown.
And so then, how many years, I guess no one that is listening would possibly know how many years you've lived in total, and I don't know whether you have any objection to telling us, but it might help to put some of these things in perspective, if you wouldn't mind.
How many years old you are? Oh.
Or would you rather not say?
Well, I'm not at all ashamed of it.
Okay.
I'm just sort of proud of myself that I made it this far. I'm now 83 years old.
Yes, okay. And you tell me that when you first started working out in the public at this store, you were, let's say, how old? 30, 35?
Something like that. Well, I maybe can straighten it out this way. My daughter and son were in the first and second grade, and I was still at it when they were in college and even when my son was working on his master's.
Okay.
That's about the time I quit.
20 years?
Oh, I was 30, and let's see now. I was 36 years old.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. So then you would say that you kind of worked out and more or less for the public doing these kinds of things like slip covering, drapering, any kind of sewing project that they had in mind.
Oh, lampshades by the carload.
Lampshades, for about what, 25 years maybe?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
Something
so
like that.
Did there come a time when you decided, I'd rather not do all these big things. I think I'd kind of like to stay home and sort of retire a little bit? I mean, you never retired. You're not retired today, but...
I'm just tired.
Did there come a time like that, Mildred?
Oh, yes, when it came time for my husband to think about retiring. Then I started sorting things out and trying to find out what I would really wanted to do and mm-hmm. what I didn't.
What, you know, during that time that you were taking on these big assignments, what do you think was the greatest challenge you were ever presented with, someone asking you to do something?
Well, probably when I worked as a stage curtain for the auditorium at Mayville State College.
Oh, my word.
And that was heavy, heavy material and very large.
Could you do that on a regular machine?
Yes, as far as that goes, the machines at that time, a regular machine would handle it. Mm-hmm. But... The weight, I couldn't handle the material, so I had to have two assistants, mm-hmm. a young man and a young lady, that one on each side of the machine that lifted the material along as we stitched it.
Well, did you consider that your most difficult job then, too, or were there some other jobs that were classified as difficult?
No, it wasn't. It wasn't difficult as far as knowing what I was doing. It was the weight there uh-huh. that made it difficult. Well, no, some of my most difficult jobs were a few of these fussy women that really didn't know what they wanted.
One day when we were talking, you were talking about sails for a sailboat. What was that story?
Oh, that was during the war, and this young man had gotten a sailboat from his grandfather, but he had everything but the sail. He couldn't buy a sail at that time, and I don't know where he got the canvas to make it, but he begged me with tears in his eyes to help him. Well, he brought some books and some measurements and some directions, and I didn't have a table big enough, so we staked it out in my backyard. I'll have to admit, I felt kind of silly crawling around in my backyard with my mouth full of pins and this nice young man. But the sale was a success, and he had a great time with it.
Was there any one job, Mildred, that provided you with perhaps more pleasure and satisfaction than the rest at this time of your life, or were there so many that...
There were so many. Mm-hmm. And some of them were big. A new house would require everything from top to bottom. Mm-hmm. And that was always a big job and a pleasure.
Was your work mostly here in Fargo, or did you ever travel outside of Fargo?
Oh, I went to several towns in North Dakota. I'd go and stay for a week, and a few in Minnesota. And the farthest I went was Eau Claire, Wisconsin, one mm-hmm. winter, and I spent 2 weeks there. Mm-hmm.
Well, we somehow, in our talk now, have seemed to have arrived at about the midpoint of your life, and yet what you've done since then seems like almost another complete lifetime, just staggering. Perhaps we could get into some of the kinds of different sorts of mediums that you've worked in. I know you've made some beautiful rugs and wall hangings. How did all that begin?
Well, I made a hooked rug when I was about 10 years old, a small one. It was not very pretty, but I did it, and I was very proud of it. And there again, my dear Aunt Laura comes into the picture. She was an artist at rugs and quilts. And I can remember sitting on the porch one summer evening, and I was coloring a Sears Roebuck catalog. She took my crayons and she copied the colors of the sunset. And later that winter, a crocheted rug appeared in one of the bedrooms and it had those colors. She was very sensitive to color. Mm-hmm. I think that came from her ancestry. My great-grandparents came from that part of Norway where Rosemaling was
originated.
Mm-hmm. And it seems all of those people had a sense of color mm-hmm. and a love of beauty. Mm-hmm. And in fact, she was born on the Atlantic Ocean.
Oh.
When the family were coming, it was in 1850. It was a very rough summer on the Atlantic. They had two tremendous storms. Many, many boats were lost. But they made it through that part. And the worst part was that between these storms, the wind completely died, and they were becalmed, and they floated around out in that ocean for approximately 3 weeks, not knowing whether they would ever see land. And during those days, Aunt Laura was born. But they made it to land, mm-hmm. and got to New York, and then they came out to Iowa. Mm-hmm. And then from Iowa, they came to Dakota Territory in 1880. Her Aunt Laura's sister, Aunt Bertha, she didn't marry. She lived up in the northwestern part of North Dakota. And she would come down for Christmas and then stay till spring, and then they would make quilts.
Ah.
And they would make quilts and rugs, and they would have quilting parties. And they were a pair because during the time they'd be together, they'd have the quilting parties in the afternoon. And in the evenings, they would just have parties, and Aunt Bertha told fortunes. Mm-hmm. And if they didn't have a gay time in the winter. And then before she went back, they'd come out to the farm, and they'd make quilts for my mother.
Well, how about you? Did you make quilts? Have you made quilts?
Oh, yes. I've made a lot of quilts.
Too many to mention?
Too many to mention.
That was just another one of the mm-hmm. directions your artwork has gone.
Well, my first quilt, Aunt Laura helped me make. I was 9 years old. It was called a nine patch. It wasn't very pretty either, but I was proud of it.
Mm-hmm. And you've gone on from there to do some things mm-hmm. that are truly artistic. Now, what about the other kinds of work that I can think of just offhand? There's crewel and needlepoint. Have you
yes.
done any of that?
Yes, I've done some needlepoint. I found that kind of tedious, so I didn't do a lot. But I'm going to do some now to incorporate some black jet nail heads that were on my mother's wedding dress. Mm-hmm. I think that would be a nice way to preserve them.
But you're going to do some sort of design then that can be framed or?
No, I'm going to cover a wooden box, a document box with it.
Oh, that sounds fascinating.
It sounds like a big job, and it is too.
Mm. Well, we haven't even really gotten around to, I guess, the second part of your life yet. So let's begin with no more hemming and hawing around. We haven't even mentioned dolls, and somehow I have a feeling that you're going to be remembered for dolls probably in a greater way than you've ever than you'll be remembered for draperies, although I will remember you for
draperies.
Well,
I think I've pretty much been forgotten about draperies because I've been out of it.
Except for people like me.
Well, yes.
Have to be as old as I am to remember that. Well, how did you first get interested in this collecting and restoring of dolls?
Well, it's kind of strange because when I began thinking about the things I would do when we retired, I knew I wouldn't be hard-pressed to find something to keep busy with because I had so many things I enjoyed doing. But I'd kind of sort of have excluded doll collecting because I had friends who did it, and I thought it was kind of messy. You had dolls all over everything.
It takes a lot of room, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. They almost crowd you out of your mm-hmm. home. As a child, I had so many dolls, and none of them survived. I think it was 1909, there were 12 dolls under our Christmas tree, and 9 of them were for me. So many uncles and aunts and relatives, grandpa and grandma's net, I got dolls and dolls.
They knew you'd love to sew for them.
Well, I was really too small then, but my two favorites, which were two China hair dolls, China head dolls. One was a brunette and one was blonde, Susie and Sadie. Mm-hmm. They existed long enough, so I did sew for them.
Mm-hmm.
But I wasn't going to collect dolls, but I got involved in a rummage sale. Well, I went to this rummage sale to take a neighbor down, and it had been going on for 3 days. And they were about to starting to pack up, and here laid a doll in the old sad state. She was all there but her wig, but her body was unstrung. And so I paid a dime for it. I thought, well, I'll take that home and fix it up and put it in the museum. Well, it sat on the shelf for several months, and then I did get it down and got some elastic. I strung it together and took some hair that had been cut from my head and when I was in high school, made a wig for it. And when I thought about dressing it, I got the underwear all right, but I couldn't remember how any of my dolls had been dressed. I found a picture of myself when I was 9 years old with my Aunt Laura in a dress that she had made for me, and so I dressed the doll like that. And after doing that, then I was hooked, as they say.
Mm-hmm.
I could see dolls every place.
Mm-hmm.
And then that doll got the title of Little Me, and she's number one in my large collection that I now have.
Mm-hmm. Well, then you began to make dolls. I recall that you've got quite a lot of dolls in your apartment that are just right from scratch. Now, who or what occasioned that?
Well, I always like to make everything, you know, anything that I possibly could make was a challenge to me. And at this,
you go ahead and have a drink of water, Mildred. Okay.
I've had got a request to dress some dolls for a project that was being worked on at that time, and they were to be dressed in the costumes of Indians and fur traders and people who were around when the
early historical characters.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And they told me to go buy the dolls. Well, as I looked at, thought about that, I couldn't see where these plastic modern dolls would do anything for an Indian costume or a fur trader. And I had been to a class in papier-mâché, and I had made one face that you could recognize as a human. And I was kind of tempted to try and make it, and I thought long enough, and I thought, well, they would be crude, but maybe they would contribute a little something to the crude costumes. So I proceeded to make 3 of them, and I presented them. This project was called The Story of Red Riverland. That was in 1967, and it was produced by North Central Council for School Television. It was shown over KFME, Channel 13. The author was Erling Nikolai Ralsrud. Well, anyway, I made the dolls, and 3 of them, and I took them to him for his approval. And he readily accepted them. And so I went home and made the rest. And they were used in this television series. And they were returned to me.
How many dolls, Red River dolls, did you have then at that point?
Nine.
Mm-hmm.
But looking at them and being exposed to our North Dakota and Minnesota history, I kind of had the bug and I wanted to make more. You know, as when I was in school, they didn't teach much history about our states. And if they did, it was always sort of apologetic. And so we didn't know much about North Dakota and much less about Minnesota because I grew up on the North Dakota side. But I got interested, and the more I read, the more I was fascinated with it. So I decided to make some more characters. And by the time I got done with that bunch, I had 26 dolls, and they took us from the, the first settlers, or the Indians, up to about the turn of the century.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I had those dolls for a long time, and they were very popular for entertainment. I was requested to show them at libraries and schools, many, many schools, and different organizations, and exhibited them in the banks, and I kind of got attached to them. Well, then the time came where I fractured my ankle. You don't go very far with a cast like that.
Mm-hmm.
So I decided to make some more. I thought, well, it would just be fun to make the people that I can remember, the people who were around as I was growing up.
Sure.
So I added 30 more
mm-hmm.
to the collection. They're not mine any longer because I have given them to the Cass County Historical Society. And after it is open, you will be able to view them at the museum at the Heritage Center.
Oh, I'm so glad to hear that those dolls are going to be viewed for many, many, many years and that they found a permanent home. That's nice for us to know.
I particularly had fun making the last three. Going through some of my scrapbooks, I found an invitation to a summer party that my grandparents had sent out in 1886. And it was, their place was called the Wild Rice Stock Farm. They had built their new home and a new barn, and this party was a dedication of the new barn.
Oh. And it, barn-warming, I guess they called
it. Barn-warming, yes.
Mm-hmm.
And it was customary.
Mm-hmm.
And that went on for many, many years until Prohibition came along. And you know what that did to barn dances. But before that, the barn dances had been a big part of the social life of the people. Well, I decided to do something about that, so I made a pair of a man and a woman who were dancing and a violinist, a fiddler.
Mm.
And I had really had a lot of fun doing that.
Mm. And just a little earlier today, you told me about some that you are still have three in mind. Was it three in mind that you want to make of the Indian group? What you told me about that? Maybe it was yesterday.
Oh, yes, yes. I have got the material together, and I have sculpted the heads. I want to make Indians to depict the Song of Hiawatha. I want to make Hiawatha, Minnehaha, and Old Nokomis with the baby Hiawatha.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, the dolls that you've constructed are not limited, I know, to the Red River dolls, although those Red River dolls are good-sized. What are they, about 20 inches?
About 12 or 14 inches.
14 inches.
14 or 15 inches, yes.
Uh-huh. And, before that or in between that or along the way, I know because I have some myself, I've got a couple of corn husk dolls. Where did that idea come from?
I don't know. Just maybe I saw one someplace and read about it, but I started to make them, and I made hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of them. They were just great at church bazaars.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them I dyed the husks with the dye and put color into them, but the most popular ones were the natural ones.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that, these were for table decorations?
Oh, yes, table decorations, yes.
Uh-huh.
They were great for that.
I also know that you have made kitchen witches and that special Norwegian character because we have one. Well, tell us about that.
Well, years back, I made a witch that was absolutely horrible. And I was chairman of a group at that time, so in October, we used her for a table decoration. And to make it interesting, I researched a little bit about witches and told the story of the Tituba, the East Indian girl in Boston that was accused of being a witch and burned at the stake. And I kind of got a liking for making ugly faces. So I continue down with it, with the big Norwegian witch. Oh, she's very ugly. She's not really a bad, in Norwegian folklore, she's not really a bad witch. She'll help you. Mm-hmm. But you have to give her coffee when she comes. In fact, she carries a coffee pot on her broomstick. And then I went into the kitchen witches that became so popular.
Mm-hmm. I think you were into those kitchen witches before the stores all had them for sale,
as I recall.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And another project in the dolls was just a simple clothespin doll. The Pioneer Daughters were looking for something to raise money to keep the cabin that they had sponsored at Bonanzaville. So I thought, well, this clothespin doll is simple. Most anybody could make it. I found out it wasn't true, though. So I got a bunch of women around my dining room table and instructed them. I could see there weren't going to be too many doll makers out of that, but one particular person worked real hard at it. And I didn't get any offers of their service after that, so I made them for the first year.
Well, now, what are we talking about now in numbers? How many hundreds of dolls did you make for sale for Bonanzaville?
Well, I don't know the first one, probably a couple of hundred, because they were, people readily bought them.
Mm-hmm, I know.
And then I had so many other things, and one of the women who had been at this class finally came up. She and her sister had decided to make them, so they took it over. And you know, that's 20 years ago, I guess, and that project is still going on, and they've sold thousands and thousands and thousands of them.
Oh, it's a real trademark at Bonanzaville, that little...
Mm-hmm.
The
first ones, I think we sold for 50 cents. Now they sell for $2.
Is that
And
right?
They've gone all over the world.
Oh, I'm sure. Well, mm-hmm. That's just one of your many wonderful ideas.
Well, the first doll that I made that I really am proud of and I love comes from a story my mother told me. She was 9 years old when she rode the covered wagon with her family to Dakota Territory. And before they left Iowa, of course, they got ready. They mended everything and knew what they could afford. My mother had never had a doll. She'd had stuffed ones that her mother had made. But I suppose they got shabby. So her mother had taken a new gunny sack, that's what we call burlap now, and washed it and rolled it up and, I suppose, tied a string around the neck and around the waist and sewed some pants buttons on it for eyes. I know they were pants buttons because that's what my mother told me they were. But you try and find pants buttons in this day of zippers. Mm-hmm. That's another problem. Well, after my mother had passed on and I had started with dolls, I thought of that story. And one day at the lake, we were cleaning the tool house and there was a burlap bag and it was fringed on the edge, and somehow or other that doll story came to me. So I washed it and made the doll from the burlap bag and with the pants buttons, and that became a popular number, very popular number.
I think that's what's so wonderful about you, Mildred. You see a clothespin, I see a clothespin, you see a clothespin dressed like a doll. I see an old gunny sack with holes in it, dirty, and you see what can be made with it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is such a wonderful quality. I remember another little character that you have made lots and lots of, and that comes out of Norwegian folklore, the Nissa?
Yes, the Nissa is singular and Nisser is plural. Mm-hmm. But I have made so many that I'd have to talk about Nisser.
Yes, I want you to.
I have a great love for Norwegian folklore, and I have a book that it was written in the Norse and then translated to the English. And I thought, well, that would be fun to make several of these characters. But the only ones that I could find that I could make anything that was attractive was the Nisser, the little Norwegian elf, who is supposed to be the spirit of the original landowner. Mm-hmm. And he hangs around that land, pardon me, to see that it's taken care of. And if you do right by the land, then Nisser will do right by you. Mm. On Christmas Eve, he will help you feed your stock and carry your wood and things like that. But if you're not good, he'll play mean little tricks on you. He'll scare the children and hide grandma's knitting, and he'll trip up the men who come home who've had a little too much ale and things like that. But he turned out to be so cute. And each one is a pleasure to make because it has a different expression.
And how big are they?
Oh, they're about 5 inches tall. Mm-hmm. And sometimes they sit on a little stump. Mm-hmm. And but if you've done right by your farm, and if you leave rice out for them, they'll do lots of favors for you.
I've seen lots of these little nisser about, and you created quite a market for this little fellow.
Yes, I have. I've been doing it for 15 years.
Nice. And you've had a little help here from various people? How do you do this?
No, I do it all
myself.
How
do you market it?
Oh, well, the marketing, yes, that comes through, like all of my work did, word of mouth.
Mm-hmm. People see it, and they ask who made it.
Friends who see it, who belong to different things, bridge clubs and other clubs, they promote them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I have one friend who is a teacher, and she really disposes of them from me. She takes them to school, and she uses them when they study about Norway and Norwegian folklore.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And another dear friend who belongs to many, many things and has a host of friends, she takes them to her home and she disposes of a lot of them. Mm-hmm. And now so many people just like to come to my house and get them. In fact, I know of instances where they've been sent to the Orient and to many places, many countries in Europe and England.
Well, that's just wonderful.
Uh-huh.
Mildred, we've talked a bit about Bonanzaville, but I know that your interest in Bonanzaville did not stop with the clothespin dolls. You just kind of wearied of that and wanted to get on to something else. And I know, because I've seen you out of Bonanzaville doing some other kinds of things. Would you like to tell me about that?
Well, and that's where I've got my first start in spinning. After working out at Bonanzaville and getting the first log cabin established, I decided to learn to spin. I'd been dusting in a couple of spinning wheels for a long time. And I had a friend who lived over the hill from my lake cabin who was a spinner. So she kindly let me come and watch her spin one afternoon. And I was infected by that bug right there. I got a fleece and washed that, and believe me, that's not a pleasant job.
I was going to ask you to go through this part because I know there are lots of people listening that don't have any idea of what to do with a spinning wheel.
Well, first you have to find someone who will sell you a fleece. And, of course, that's very dirty. And it takes some washing. First you sort it, and it's filled with straw and burrs and dead ticks and sand and oil. It's really quite a job to wash it. But it's a new experience, and nothing like that ever bothered me if I could see what was coming ahead.
Yeah.
Well, I got my fleece washed, and I took some of it, and the dear lady showed me how to card it. That's where you lay all your fibers in one direction, and you make it in a roll, and then you can spin it. But I spent a couple of hours, and then I went back to my cabin, and I started to spin, and I did.
Where does this carder come in, you know, the thing that you card the wool with? We have one of those somewhere around now. Where does that operation come in?
Well, you have to do that before you spin.
Mm-hmm.
So you get all of this foreign matter and the knots and things.
So then you're just, with this fluffy business, you've
mm-hmm.
got a whole bunch of fluffy wool.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
And then you roll it into little rolls. They're called rolags, and you take one at a time, mm-hmm. and you put it in through the orifice, and the spindle twists it, which makes yarn.
Into the yarn.
Well, anyway, I got some of the wool to go through that orifice and started to wind on the spindle, and it was really lumpy. But I had the courage to go out to Bonanza during fair week, and I started to spin. Well, it was fun because I had no competition to show me up. There was nobody there who knew anything.
Who better,
knew,
huh?
Knew what I was doing, so they accepted it, but I made a lot of people happy.
This was your basic training, was it?
That's right.
Well, then this began to accumulate, all this, what do you want to call it?
Yarn.
Raw yarn,
yeah,
I mean yarn that was just the fleece color. And then I know that... from visiting your home, I've seen batches of yarn hanging of various beautiful shades and so on. I wish you'd tell us about that part.
Well, I didn't care to knit. You had to use this yarn up, you know. You couldn't just keep it, let it stack up. And by that time, people were so needlework conscious that I decided to do needle weaving. Well, I dyed it and I made some of the dyes, I used the natural dyes, but that was a lot of work and you didn't get too many colors. But I had, previously I had dyed wools for my hooked rugs, so I had a very fast color dye that, and the shades were very lovely. They weren't loud.
How did you get those shades?
You could get five shades from the same color if you learned how
You just dipped it in longer?
Yes.
Something like what they do with candles to get the right shade?
Well, I haven't made candles, I did when I was a kid. I made some crude ones. No, you measure your dye and you measure you weigh your wool and that, and then you use a mordant to make fast color.
You mentioned natural dyes, and I think that's kind of interesting. I can remember from my childhood onion skins that made the yellow shades, and we did that when we dyed Easter eggs. But then, what are some of the other kinds of things that she used?
Oh, sumac and...
what color does sumac make?
Most of the natural dyes either make a beige or a yellow. Very few make green or red, and no blue. And they're all very much the same color, but...
kind of earth tones?
They're kind of very neutral. Mm-hmm. But I did find one interesting thing. I finally found a use for cockle burrs.
Oh.
You know how irritating they are. Mm-hmm. The horse's tails and in your clothing if you get near them. But they made a lovely soft beige that was different than the others. Mm. Of course, that was hard to do. You picked them with a stick and put them in the water. You didn't get near them.
Mm-hmm.
But by boiling them and then straining out the liquid, you could make a lovely dye. Mm-hmm. And mushrooms. Some mushrooms. I have a lovely wall hanging that I made of the design is of mushrooms, but the shades in the background of the weaving were made from big brown mushrooms that grew around my lake cabin.
You talk now about needle weaving, and I'm not sure that all of the people who are listening now would know what exactly that was.
No, and usually weaving is done on a loom where you and in strips or squares or something like that. But this is sort of an embroidery. You don't use a regular loom. You use a hoop or a box or a branch, and you warp that. And usually it's left in for the frame. And you use a shuttle. You use a needle with the long lengths of your thread. And it's just unlimited. You can do anything.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I started doing, and I wouldn't get one finished till another one was already forming in my mind.
You know, I just know that the people that are listening to us have no idea of the quantities of these things that you have done, because, like myself, I'll do one or two or three things, and then I quit. But what do you do, 1 or 2 or 300?
Well, maybe. I'm sure
I don't know.
Well, like the dolls, when you give demonstrations, people want them.
Mm-hmm.
And I was kind of in the front of all the needle weavers and the spinners here. And I had it right away. I got calls from clubs and groups and classes and schools to demonstrate. Well, I took my needle weavings along, and I seldom brought any of them home. I particularly remember one call that came in a hurry. There was a meeting of flying farmers. And, of course, they brought their wives along. And there was to be a luncheon for the wives. And the lady, this was from the western part of the state, who had written to Barbara Watson at Dayton's for a style show. Well, she couldn't book them for that particular date because she was already booked. And they asked her if she could refer them to someone who would be interesting. And I had recently worked with her at the Centennial Style Show, so she gave them my name, and I got a call, and 3 days later, I was out at the Holiday Inn spinning. And I particularly enjoyed that one because the introduction, I told them that I was, they wanted to know who I was, and I said, oh, I was just an old woman who was hooked on spinning. But I said, in my young days, I was pretty much hooked on the very same things your husbands are. And I told them about my experience of meeting a young man who was an aviator and flying with him. And they sat just entranced by the spinning and the demonstration, and the minute I said I was done, they came in a wave right up there, and my tables were bare.
Oh, that's wonderful. You're along this line, I recall that one of your friends commented on your productivity, and she used a fascinating expression.
Oh, she spent a Sunday afternoon, she and her sister, at our house, and viewed the different things, and then I got a note from her later, and she referred to that as inexhaustible makingness.
Wonderful. I'm going to ask you a question that I know you've been asked before. How come you can do all these things?
Well, I have a very simple little philosophy. If you see something that you think you might like to do, try it. Sometimes it works.
Well, does that tie in somehow with, as you said, your philosophy of life? You think, you pretty much think that if a person really wants to and tries it, they can do it?
Sure they can.
Just like Grandma Moses and her pictures.
That's right.
Well, I kind of think
I'm not quite as old as Grandma Moses, but I'm trying to make it.
You're sneaking up on that, Mildred. Well, I want to thank you for sharing parts of your life with us. I do thank you.
Well, I thank you for accepting me. The things I have done have opened so many doors to me, and I've made so many friends, and their memories such a big part of the future days of my life. And you are one of them.
Thank you. You've not retired yet, Mildred Heifert.